Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society show, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles published by the Geographic Society in May of 2025. I hope you enjoy the program today. We'll begin with this article, Do Fish Sleep? Here's what scientists have discovered so far. Sleep in fish may look different from humans, but rest is essential for survival. Here's what experts have to say about fish sleep. By Jason Bittle. If you've ever gone snorkeling on a coral reef during the day, you likely saw waves of brightly colored fish of all shapes and sizes. But return to the same spot in the middle of the night, and most of those same creatures will have vanished. Which might make one wonder, do fish sleep? All animals that have been carefully examined show sleep, says Philippe Murrain, a neuroscientist at Stanford University. Where things get complicated is when you start to ask questions about what we know about that sleep, says Murrain. For instance, in 2019, Murrain and his colleagues were able to observe zebrafish beneath a microscope as they snoozed in petri dishes of goo. This allowed the team to measure sleep patterns in the fish for the first time, patterns that looked surprisingly similar to our own deep sleep. The zebrafish even exhibited what looked like rapid eye movement, or REM. With at least 20,000 species of fish known to science, behaviors vary widely across the many different kinds of fish. Some may exhibit features more like those we're used to seeing from mammals, while others perform rest-like states that are unlike anything we're used to. Most research suggests that brains need downtime, says Michael Hothaus, a marine biologist at Florida International University. Whether that's to clear toxins or simply to rest is less understood. But given that fish brains are very similar to our own, it's no surprise that fish need to power down from time to time, too. Do sharks sleep? You might have heard that if a shark stops moving, it will suffocate and die. And while that is true for some sharks, the rule is not absolute. For starters, there are two ways that fish breathe, says Craig Radford, a sensory biologist at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. There's what's known as ram ventilation, in which the fish must swim to force water across its gills. However, some fish can breathe through buccal pumping, which is when the animal moves part of its jaw or body to pump water across its gills. One example of buccal pumping can be seen from footage collected by divers in 2017 that revealed about 20 white-tip reef sharks huddled together in mostly motionless pile. Our work on some sharks, mainly the carpet shark, shows that they shut their eyes and we can arouse them using a stimulus, says Radford. However, carpet sharks and most other kinds of fish have not yet been submitted to the kinds of thorough empirical sleep testing as Murrain's team was able to conduct on the zebrafish. But even sharks that rely on ram ventilating have tricks. Some of these reef sharks may just kind of hang out in the currents during the day and get the oxygen flowing over their gills, says Hothaus. They're just kind of hanging out. Other species appear to use a different sort of workaround. Researchers in California have noticed that baby white sharks will just swim in this big circle very slowly, says Heidhaus. The patterns are so regular, the sharks leave markings in the sand on the seafloor, which kind of look like crop circles. While scientists can't say for sure, it seems likely that the sharks are going into a sort of autopilot mode, where they continue to swim and breathe, but in a way that allows their brains to recharge. This makes Heidhaus believe that the sharks may be able to perform what's known as unihemispheric sleep, also known as slow wave sleep, which means they sleep with one half of their neocortex at a time. Dolphins have been shown to do this, by the way. They are kind of still thinking about breathing, coming up to breathe, and they're pseudo-alert, says Heidhaus. And that's kind of sleeping for them. Obviously, dolphins are mammals, not fish, but it's possible whites and other sharks have evolved a similar behavior. Do fish sleep at night? Just like life on land, animals below the water's surface keep all sorts of different hours. While many fish are active during the day and rest at night, the opposite can also be true. Many kinds of reef sharks are active at night. What's more, every single night, there's a massive global movement of plankton, which sense the setting of the sun and rise out of the depths to feed near the surface. It's known as the Dial Vertical Migration, and it's considered to be the largest migration of animals on Earth. As the plankton ascend, so do their predators, and the predators of those predators, in a parade of biomass that plays an enormous role in the way nutrients are cycled through the planet's oceans. Parrotfish use their mucus to sleep peacefully. While many fish simply find a quiet spot to drift off at night, parrotfish take bedtime to the next level, secreting themselves inside a layer of mucus, like underwater sleeping bags. Parrotfish make these kinds of mucus bags, and they just sit in them at night on the reef, says Heidhaus. The mucus layer seems to protect parrotfish against predators and parasites, while the hefty turquoise fish relax. There's also evidence that the ooze contains antibiotics that ward off pathogens, and the sealed chamber may also prevent the fish's scent from attracting unwanted attention. Interestingly, disturbing the mucus cocoon will alert the fish and send it swimming off at high speed, almost like an alarm clock. Do deep sea fish sleep? Even in the ocean's depths, where sunlight never reaches, fish still probably undergo some form of rest, though it may not look like anything we're used to. I suspect most deep-sea fish still have circadian rhythms, as these don't need to be entrained by light, says Radford. There are clock genes that can regulate circadian clocks, so light is not the only regulatory mechanism. In another example, blind cavefish in Mexico were found to perform a kind of sleep during the day. The animals stopped moving until they were poked, at which point they'd start swimming again, while remaining more active at night. Yet more evidence that fish can be either diurnal or day active, as well as nocturnal, or even crepuscular, with activity peaking near dusk and dawn. In the end, fish are more like humans than we often give them credit for. Fish were the first vertebrates on this beautiful earth, says Moraine, so it's really not, do they sleep like us? It's, do we sleep like them? That completes the article. The title was Do Fish Sleep? Here's what scientists have discovered So Far by Jason Bittel. Our next title is Ancient Greeks and Romans Were Obsessed with Diet Advice Too. From protein-filled meals to the benefits of lentils and intermittent fasting, the classical world had strong opinions about how to stay healthy. Written by Candida Moss. Before Instagram trends and DNA-based diets, Greek and Roman physicians used diet as the primary form of health care. Shockingly, their advice seems both modern and remarkably sensible. Too much red meat, specifically beef, could lead to cancer, wrote the 2nd century CE Roman medic Galen. Those who were looking to lose weight, wrote Hippocrates, should try what we call fasting cardio, exercising on an empty stomach before eating. And chicken soup, which Dioscorides, the father of pharmacology, is very often given to those in poor health in order to set them to rights. The most important thing of all, wrote the Roman writer Celsus, is that everyone should be familiar with the nature of their own body. Most people have some kind of bodily weakness, he continued, and whether or not you're inclined to gain weight or struggle to keep it on, to be constipated, or to have food pass right through you, whichever part of the most problematic should always get the most attention. And we should adjust our diets accordingly. It's all about balance. Ancient ideas about diet were grounded in archaic theories about how the body worked. Most Greek and Roman doctors believed that all bodies existed on a spectrum of hot, cold, wet, and dry. In general, from the Roman doctor Galen onwards, the properties of wet, dry, hot, and cold were believed to correspond to humors, or substances in the body. Blood was hot and moist. Phlegm was cold and moist. Black bile was cold and dry, and yellow bile was hot and dry. As early as Hippocrates, it was believed that a deficiency or excess in one of these substances would lead to pain and disease. The primary ways to regulate them was through exercise, which would heat the body, and diet, which, depending on the substances, could either cool or heat the body from within. Some bodies, such as those of women, were considered more predisposed to be wet, while others, like young men, were hotter and drier. But broadly speaking, health could be found by keeping these properties in balance, explains Carol Bubb, assistant professor of classical literature and science at the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World at NYU, and author of the recently published How to Eat, An Ancient Guide for Healthy Living. To put it fairly simplistically, Bubb says, the basic theory was that a patient who was suffering from a hot and dry disease, example cholera, would likely find some relief in a cool and moist diet, and it would be considerably less risky to give someone some lettuce than to give them a drug, whose downside risk could be catastrophic. Lettuce was seen as a cooling food that could regulate body temperature in those who were overheating, whether because of their intrinsic nature, because of disease, or because of the weather. Many of the heating and cooling properties of foodstuff feel instinctive. Lettuce and cucumbers are cooling, but arugula is heating because it is peppery. Meat is a heating food, particularly if it is prepared through roasting, which does not use liquid and utilizes higher temperatures in preparation. Crudites are cooling food, and thus better reserved for summer, when the body needs to be cooled down. According to ancient medics, these prescriptions worked, Galen claimed in On the Properties of Foodstuffs that as a young man, who on account of his age was hotter, he successfully used lettuce for its cooling properties. Now that he was older, it had taken on a new use as a sleep aid. The only remedy against insomnia for me, he wrote, was lettuce eaten in the evening. While diet was important for diagnosing and treating disease, it was even more essential as a means of preventing illness. With surgical and pharmaceutical treatments in their infancy, most illnesses were incurable. As a result, diet was preventative health care, and one of the few ways a person could try to avoid sickness. If a person needed to be cooled down, wrote Celsus in On Medicine, they should drink cold water, sleep, and eat acidic foods. If they needed to be warmed up, they should eat all salty, bitter, and meaty foods. Personalized diet. Ancient dietary advice was extremely personalized, says Bub. The ideal diet needs to be tailored to the individual, so the idea of a universal recommended daily amount would not have made much sense. An ancient athlete, a beefy gladiator, for example, was advised to eat nourishing, fortifying food like pork or beef. An ancient office worker, stuck behind a desk all day doing bookkeeping or other bureaucratic tasks, would be better with lighter food like fish. But some people, the ancient Dr. Galen noted, digested beef more easily than fish. The rules would be different for them. In general, most patients were advised to follow two key principles: eat seasonally and avoid drastic changes. The former was less about availability, in that sense everyone ate seasonally, and more about adjusting for the weather. In summer, eat light, cooling foods, cucumbers, lettuce, raw vegetables. In winter, consume a warming diet of heavier, comfort foods, roasted meat, and bread. While most of these authors were partaking in what we might call the Mediterranean diet, olive oil, fish, vegetables, and grains, an ancient person's diet was conditioned by their socioeconomic status. The foundations of the average diet were lentils, bread of the denser, darker kind, a fermented fish sauce known as garum, and occasional fish, and in a good week, meat. The wealthy had access to highly seasoned and prepared foodstuffs, a wide array of different kinds of meats and fish, like flamingo tongue and panther. As for drastic changes, while ancient physicians understood the desire for bodily transformation, they believed that radical shifts in diet could cause illness. Transitioning from a winter to a summer diet overnight, for example, was seen as extreme. As extreme as going from a sedentary lifestyle one week to running marathons the next. Celsus warned, you can't go from overexertion to sudden rest, nor from extended rest straight to exertion without seriously bad effects. Even when switching from season to season and increasing exercise, wrote Diocles in his Regimen for Health, you should ramp it up slowly and be cautious of overdoing it. Interestingly, modern studies agree with what the ancients believed. Small, incremental lifestyle changes are much more effective and sustainable for improving overall health than large, abrupt ones. Dietary wars. While modern doctors debate the nutritional value of various kinds of fat, with good fats like avocados and nuts being recommended, while fried foods and processed meats are tied to heart disease. Ancient experts disagreed about ingredients like lentils. Lentils were valorized by Stoic philosophers like Zeno of Citium and Musonius Rufus, for whom diet was very much about self-restraint and avoiding the excesses of fancy foreign foods. In On Keeping Well, the Greek writer Plutarch argued that no one should stray too far from a simple diet of lentils because, quote, less expensive things are always healthier for the body, end quote. But for many Roman doctors, Bub said, lentils were viewed as very unhealthy. Dioscorides claimed in his Medical Substances that, quote, the lentil, when eaten steadily, causes dim-sightedness, poor digestion, stomach ache, gas, and constipation in the bowels, end quote. Similarly, while most people praised the merits of cabbage as a kind of miracle cure-all, others disagreed. Cabbage, wrote Cato the Elder, a Roman statesman and the author of a work on farming, quote, is the vegetable that surpasses all others, end quote. It could be eaten raw or cooked and sprinkled with vinegar. It did the belly good, even producing urine that itself had medicinal properties. Eaten before a party, he added, it could help prevent a hangover and indigestion from overeating. It not only cleansed the body, but it could also clear the head. Writing 3 centuries later, Galen, undoubtedly the better doctor, disagreed. While he acknowledged that cabbage had cleansing properties, he wrote in On the Properties of Foodstuffs that it is, quote, emphatically not a wholesome food, like lettuce is, but has a pernicious and bad-smelling juice, end quote. Fasting and good fats. Some aspects of ancient dietary advice cohere surprisingly well with modern lifestyle trends and philosophies. As early as the 5th century BCE, Bub said, Hippocratic texts advised people to try intermittent fasting. 1 meal a day was common. Cross-training by sailing, hunting, and walking on varied terrain, and eating a high-fat diet. Think butter, sheep's cheese, and olive oil to lose weight. Dishes should be high in fat, wrote Hippocrates, so that the dieter feels satiated after the smallest amount. Today, scientists agree that, in a controlled environment, fat does have an effect on satiety. Still, not all the advice seems practical or even safe for the health-conscious today. The comparatively limited range of medical treatments meant that Hippocratic doctors often recommended routine purging and advised wine for people of all ages, albeit watered down. Extensive time spent bathing and getting massages, prescribed as part of a general health-preserving regimen, sounds appealing, but would make it difficult to maintain modern work hours. And then there's the quirky stuff, the ancient fixation on cabbage, which was almost a universal drug to many around the ancient Mediterranean, seems fairly innocuous. But Bub notes that other ancient medical opinions are more dubious, such as the idea that rotting basil spontaneously breeds scorpions, that eating too many figs causes head lice, that fruit is generally very bad for you, or that walking around nude is a good weight loss strategy. And that ends the article today. Ancient Greeks and Romans were obsessed with diet advice too. It's written by Candida Moss. And that also completes the program for today. This has been the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by SunSounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your SunSounds volunteer reader, and it's been my privilege to be that. I hope you've enjoyed the program today. The articles I've been reading were all published by the Geographic Society in May of 2025. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to SunSounds of Arizona with its premium programming offered on a 24/7 basis. And if you've missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website. On the first page, click on Broadcast Info and Audio. On the next page, click on the words Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of articles available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.